Your Royal Highness, Eminences, Excellencies, Reverend Fathers, dear sisters and brothers, it's indeed an honor to be here among you, and I am thankful first and foremost to God, who allows us opportunities to meet and builds relationships and allows us to interact for the good of his people and the good of his world. And it is through one of these meetings that we had in London that I met His Royal Highness some years ago. He has graced us with his visit to our center in the United Kingdom, and I have visited His Royal Highness in London on occasions, and so I'm thankful for this invitation. Slightly daunting, for those of you, of course, you will all know His Royal Highness. And I don't know how many of you would be willing to stand and speak in his presence. But I am humbled and I am honored to be able to do so. I bring you greetings from our Holy Father, His Holiness Pope Tawadros II, Pope of Alexandria, Patriarch of the See of St. Mark, whom I was with in Cairo only 3 days ago at the consecration of our new Metropolitan Archbishop of the Coptic Orthodox Church to Jerusalem and the Gulf, His Eminence Metropolitan Antonius. I bring you greetings of His Eminence. It was ironic that I had to excuse myself from being with him to come and visit his diocese before he entered, but I assured him that I would deliver his greetings to you, and I assure you of his prayers. We're all here for one reason, and that is to speak about the Middle East. The Middle East is undeniably a place of culture and of heritage. And I remember one particular time in the year 2000 when the whole world was celebrating its second millennium, that an incredibly bright advertising executive in Egypt came up with one of the most intelligent campaigns I have seen. And that was, Egypt, welcome to our seventh millennium. That is not something that is just shared with Egypt, though. This whole region is built upon heritage, history, culture, and many things that bring us together. Many things that the world learns from. It is also the birthplace of religions. Faithful, honorable religions that are the foundations of more than half of the world's population. Religions that should hold us together, that should allow us to stand, and should allow us to witness. Of course, unfortunately, there are many people today in the world who look at this region and see it only as a place of conflict and a place of hopelessness. Those people, however, are the ones who generally have no relationship with the region. But those who do, those who come, under whichever circumstances, in whichever context, are the ones who work for its well-being and work with a sense of hope and know that there is something more to offer. But it is now a time for change. It is a time of change to show people, to show the world, that there is an opportunity of good. That there is an opportunity because religion is at our core, that we can actually do better. Of course, what we must do is stand against those who speak and tell us that religion now is hopeless and needless, and in actual fact, merely a source of conflict. We need to present this as a solution, not a problem, and as peace, not as conflict. For us as civic leaders, religious leaders, this is a great opportunity to change the narrative and the expectation. You see, people now have no expectation, except that things will go from bad to worse, that things will be met with greater and greater failure. But we know, because of our faith, that there is always hope, and that is the hope that we build upon. You see, if we do not change this narrative, it will continue to go down the same road, and people will continue to have the same opinion, and it will become a self-propelling prophecy that we will fail. There is a challenge, though, and that challenge is, although we are religious, elements of freedom, of citizenship, elements of cohesion and acceptance and rights need to be a-religious. They need to deal with all equally. But the problem with the region, this region, is often when you say something is a-religious, it is taken to mean that it is sacrilegious. You see, my religion, my faith, tells me that God created all of humanity in his image and according to his likeness. And all equally respected, equally loved, equally bestowed with freedom, equally cherished, and equally called. The whole of humanity. But at the same time, he leaves us with a freedom to choose him and allows us the opportunity to choose him. But in being so gracious and in being so accommodating and respecting his own creation as he does, he has even given us the opportunity and the right and the freedom to reject him, wanting us to choose him first and foremost. And so when we do choose him, we need to choose him and everything that comes with him. I cannot choose God, but decide that I'm going to deal differently with different people. I cannot choose God, but at the same time choose to act with prejudice. And that is our challenge. We need to be hope in an increasing hopelessness and light in an increasing darkness. It's not enough for us to lead at good times, at easy times. But good leadership is especially required at the most difficult of times. In fact, it is essential, because it is at those difficult times that people look to a beacon, look to someone to follow. And we need to look and see who those people are. There are many of them in this room. There are many of them in this region. There are many of them who are still undetected. But the reality is, there are many of them. We need to reclaim territory. You see, unfortunately, over the past decades, there is an abuse and a misuse of religion. And we are held accountable for it. But we cannot just turn a blind eye to it anymore. We can't just ignore it anymore. The world has changed. The world has changed because before, decades ago, we lived in our own silos. Someone who lived in one country would probably live and die in that country, sometimes without experiencing anybody else. So it was easy just to look after ourselves. It was easy just to be surrounded by people who were the same. But in the changing dynamics, in the changing demographics we have, with the increase of social media, with the increase of migration and movement, we are now indeed a greater global village. We encounter different people all the time. And the test of our ethics, our morality, our faith, our religions, is how we deal with those people who are different. Not how we deal with people who are the same. Because the same is easy. Well, sometimes. But what is different is the greatest challenge. You see, we need to look at our challenges both internally and externally. Internally, there is a radicalism, a politicization, and an abuse of religion. We have seen some within religions that condemn those of the same religion. And externally, there are many who tell us that religion as a whole, because of misuses that they have seen over decades and centuries, religion is no longer relevant. Religion is actually something that should be done away with, that should be removed, and all of our problems will be solved. The reality of the situation is that for decades we have turned a blind eye in the Middle East to prejudice, to inequality. We have turned a blind eye to marginalization. As long as it was somewhere contained, it didn't matter. As long as it happened to somebody else, it didn't matter. But there is always, with sin, a pushing of boundaries. Evil continues to push boundaries. Today with me, tomorrow with you, the day after with everybody else here, and so on and so forth. And with those boundaries being pushed, what we have seen is a new ethos, a new thought in the Middle East that has become so narrow, with such a narrow perspective, that one must be of a particular shape, live a particular life, otherwise that person is condemned. It has become so narrow and the mold has become so tight that even people of the same faith are condemned as being unfaithful. They are condemned as being traitors, unworthy. This is what we're living today. But it's not just a problem of some. It needs to be addressed by us all. At this time, I want to pay particular tribute to Jordan. Of course, I've encountered His Royal Highness and others from Jordan. But since arriving here just yesterday, I have seen the welcome. And of course, not just the official welcome, although it was wonderful, but just a normal welcome of people in the street, staff at the hotel, people at the center, drivers, passers-by, civilians. How they deal with me as an obviously Christian clergyman. Someone who is different to 90% of the population of this place. And that is a great tribute, because that is indicative of the nature that we are seeking and the world that we want to replicate. This is the model that people need to be seeing. Not what's happening in Iraq, in parts of Syria and Libya. It would be very unfair to tell the world that that is the Middle East, because there is so much more to it. But in doing that, the way we need to affect it is we need to raise our expectations of ourselves. We need to realize that we are capable of more and better and more honorable. We need to realize that this is not a status quo that needs to be kept, but one that must be challenged. This is a status quo that can, should, and must be broken. Inequality is an indictment of all of us. The fact that it exists is a reflection on everyone. And so we need to work to alleviate that. Not because of public relations, not because of how we look in front of the West or anyone else, but because this is what must be done. This is the faithful thing. This is God's will for us. This, for us, is what will stop things that we have seen. This, for us, will stop what we have seen in further displacement. I've had the honor and blessing over the past year of visiting both Erbil and the refugee camps there, and then the Greek-Macedonian border that many of you may have seen on your television screens this morning with a lot of conflict, and have been able to see both sides of an incredibly painful refugee crisis. Ones that sit waiting to go somewhere, and others that have taken a treacherous journey in what they themselves call death boats to a life that is unknown and undetermined. But of course, if you are going to risk everything to be on a death boat, to go to a life that is undetermined, it must be better than what you're leaving behind. And that is what is saddening. That is what must be addressed. Quotas, numbers, statistics, whether people are defined as refugees or economic migrants, these are all matters we're following in the news. This is all rhetoric we're hearing. But these are not mere statistics, these are people. How many people will be taken in to Europe? A million and a half, 2 million, 3 million? That's not a solution. Because as far as we know, there are 12 to 13 million displaced now, and that number will increase. So surely the solution is not just to find somewhere for people to go, but it is to look at their own countries of origin, where they have been indigenous people who belong, who contribute, and see how they can stay. To resolve conflict that has scattered families and communities and societies and nations, and see how that can be addressed. To solve the problem on the ground rather than just solving the results of the problem across the seas. This is where we look at what it means to be alive, what it means to have human dignity. To be able to live is not a privilege, it is a right. To be able to be equal and considered equally is not a privilege, it's a right. And it's a right not only enshrined in international law, and examples of Article 19 of the International Declaration, that is merely how we note it, write it down in our human ways. These rights were given millennia ago by God Himself to His creation, and those are the rights we must honor. When God created us, He didn't decide to create us in sections. He created us the same. In the Epistle to the Galatians, we're told that there is neither Jew nor Greek, slave nor free, male nor female, but all one. Are we dealing with everyone as one? And forgive me if I sound like I am well and truly preaching to the choir, because the fact that you are here means you know all this and you agree with it and you actually work towards it. But this is addressed to everyone else who still needs to see. And at the risk of quoting someone who is not a writer of an epistle or a gospel, if we listen to Albert Einstein, who says to us that insanity is doing the same thing over and over again and expecting something that is different, then we need to observe that. What is required of us, and what I have seen here through this institute, through this initiative, through His Royal Highness, through this kingdom, is something that is new. And it not only needs to be spoken about, it needs to be celebrated. There needs to be a proactive program of social cohesion, equality, nation building, to make people feel that they are really valued. Because if they feel that value, then why would they leave their countries? If they feel that value, why would they leave their place of heritage? But they need to live free and safe and prosperous. And I think that's what we need to adjust. This is not about handouts and provision. It is about prosperity. It's not about protection. It's about living in safety. And it's not about mere survival. It's about living with dignity. Again, in the Epistle to the Romans, we're told that we must speak. Because if we do not speak, people will not listen. If they do not listen, then how will they act? And if they do not act, then how will they present God to others? It's not by coincidence that our Lord in the New Testament says to us that people will see our good works and glorify our Father in heaven. Likewise, they see everything we do wrong, and they condemn not us, not just our religions, but they condemn our God. Because suddenly it becomes His fault. I have a great deal of trouble with the language that we often use now. The language of the Christian West and the Muslim East. As I was saying earlier, I think that now there is no longer scope for that language. Because if we use that language, if we use the Christian West and the Muslim East, then that means that Muslims living in the West are mere guests, and Christians living in the East are mere guests. But in actual fact, that can't be true. Because there are Christians who have been living here for 2 millennia. If you really want to offend a Palestinian Christian, ask him when his family became Christian, which is a question that many people ask when they come. When did you, and most of them will say 2,000 years ago. And undoubtedly in the West, there have been Muslim communities for so long that they are second, third, fourth generation. So again, this language, this divisive language, this language that puts us into boxes needs to change. If we keep doing the same thing, we'll keep getting the same result. It is time to do things differently. The indication of a community, of a society, is how it deals with its members. Now, the term minority is a loaded term. As Christians, we reject the status of a minority, although we are indeed a numeric minority in the Middle East. And I will give you one frightening statistic. 25 years ago, the Christian presence of the Middle East was about 25%. Now, the Christian presence in the Middle East is about 5%. That's not the frightening part. The frightening part is 4 of those 5% are in Egypt. Egypt, the Christians of Egypt, represent 80% of the Christians in the Middle East, which means amongst the whole rest of the Middle East, there's only 1% left. And still people are leaving. They're leaving, and that is going to be an effect that we're all going to feel. One thing people don't understand is when individuals and families migrate, everyone looks at it as a land of prosperity, but they suffer, they struggle, they need to integrate, they need to go into new communities and new societies, they need to lead new lives. They struggle. And the region here struggles because it hemorrhages good people, Christians and Muslims, Yazidis, anyone who feels that he or she no longer has a place. And it becomes more and more of a problem because the concentration of those who don't want them then increases proportionately. And it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy in that people who want to stay are not able to, so they leave. And the ones who stay, actually, are the ones who become even more intolerant. I'm talking terminology, so please forgive me. We speak about tolerance quite a lot. But to me, I find that word very challenging. To tolerate is to merely put up with. We should never be tolerating. As a Christian, when I'm serving my people, I never tell them to tolerate. Because our scriptures tell us to love even our enemies, to accept those who persecute us. And I have seen that same love within the community here, within the communities around the Middle East. It is not just about tolerance. It is about membership, ownership, cohesion. It's about a sense of identity and belonging. There is nothing more painful than to feel that you are tolerated. In actual fact, what you should feel is that you are welcomed and embraced and celebrated. For your diversity, for your difference. It's easy to celebrate people who are like us because, of course, I think I'm good. So everyone like me must be good as well. But when I'm able to look at others who are so different to me and still celebrate them, then that is a true indication of a true person in the true image and likeness of God. Nelson Mandela said that to deny people their human rights is to challenge their very humanity. And so if we look at the opposite, we then think that to give people their human rights is to enforce and celebrate and secure their humanity. And surely God wants nothing more and better from us than that. A few weeks ago, there was a declaration that came out of Marrakesh. And I want to quote one part of it that says, "It is calling for a broad movement for the just treatment of religious minorities in Muslim countries and to raise awareness as to their rights and to work together to ensure the success of these efforts." Now that goes very closely with the Amman message that also speaks about Muslim leaders and says, "It is they who will enlighten our youth. It is our scholars who will keep the youth from sliding down the path of ignorance, corruption, closed-mindedness, subordination, and the abyss of extremism." Those are strong voices. Those are welcome voices. I was saying earlier to His Royal Highness and over lunch that I feel for my Muslim sisters and brothers. Because they wake up in the morning, they switch on their televisions, look at their news feeds, read their newspapers, and all they see is things done in their name. And the response must be, "Not in my name." But I can't say that. It is up to scholars from within Islam to challenge those who are polluting and poisoning the minds of young people all over the world. It is no longer a contained problem. It is up to them to say either these texts are wrong or to present a viable, nuanced, creative way of using the text that guides these peoples and their minds and their energy to a greater and more godly direction. But it's our responsibility then, once these people speak up, to support them. I was speaking at the Church of England General Synod last year and said to them that while we encourage our Muslim brothers to speak, we must stand by them, because in speaking, they themselves become marginalized. They themselves become targeted. I am under no delusion whatsoever that in speaking out so robustly, His Royal Highness comes under a lot of attack. And anyone who speaks like him will come under a lot of attack. But it apparently doesn't matter. And he continues to speak. And long may he speak. So our hope is in our collaboration. Our hope is in our cooperation. I keep quoting different people, I'm sorry, but I did some research because of the type of audience I was going to have, and realized that Mahatma Gandhi had such a wonderful expression. He said that you should never ever condemn the whole of humanity because of the actions of some. Because he said, the sea is so wide that a few drops of corruption in that sea do not change the nature of the sea. Our humanity is the creation of God, in His image, in His likeness, according to His will, for His purpose. And no one, and nothing, and no organization, and no movement, and no... I think I should stop there. No one can change that. No one can change that. Because with God, they also have such faithful people as yourselves who continue to witness. So that collaboration is important. That collective power is important. We celebrate our diversity. We look at what we can do. We change the dialogue. We change the rhetoric. We change the conversation. Our opportunity is now. And our opportunity is now because the difference has become so great between what is happening and what should happen. If nothing has come of this so-called Arab Spring, at least one thing has. It has created an environment where everything has come out of the woodwork. Everyone has been revealed. Everything has been revealed. People who had myths and mythology that lasted 70 years, who said that they were the solution, suddenly realized that they were no solution. And then now it's up to us. It's up to us to sit in that place, to fill that gap now. Now that all the hopelessness is there, we are the presence of hope. Our meeting here is the presence of hope. Your work here is the presence of hope. The many millions like you around the world are the presence of hope. And so we need to take that. We need to take that opportunity. We need to reclaim religion and say that it is a powerful, ethical model of value and morality that we live by and that we even lay down our lives for. Not take the lives of others for, but lay down our lives for. We need to respect and value human life as God's creation, in whichever form it is. Being blind to race, ethnicity, religion, color, but protecting the God-given right that He has so graciously bestowed upon us. And in conclusion, we're told in our scriptures that we are the light of the world, that a city set on a hill cannot be hidden, that that lamp should be placed on a lampstand that it may give light to the whole house. Our world today needs light. Our world today needs that light of hope, that light that is able to conquer all darkness, that light that works through you, through your conscience, that light that works through your commitment and through your focus. And I am thankful for that light. I made a point of coming from England and not speaking about conflict because I want you to know that I look at the Middle East and I see hope. The fact that you live and you breathe and you work and you do what you do is that hope. You have heard too many messages of condemnation. You've had too many messages of hopelessness. Enough. The time has come. The time has come that we not only react to those messages, but we become proactive and take those matters into our hands and show the alternative model. The light of God is infinitely more powerful and effective than any darkness. And it can break that darkness, and it will break that darkness. This meeting is that light. This spirit is that light. The spirit of collaboration and cooperation is that light, and it is so needed. If that is the case, then what darkness could possibly overcome all of this? By doing what we are doing, by calling for what we call for, by protecting what God has given us, we honor God, we honor His people, We honor his creation. And we provide hope in him for all who meet us and see us and receive the bountiful mercy that he provides and the powerful gifts that he gives so abundantly. Thank you.